And another southern paleontologist who's moved north to Oxford is Dr. Roger Close, and he's trying to solve a mega mystery. How do you work out a pattern of evolution across the ages and the globe when so many fossils are buried in inconvenient places, under forests or deep granite?
Where do you go for your digs?
I have done some digs in the past, including in Australia. So I grew up in Melbourne. I spent about 10 years digging up dinosaurs and other terrestrial animals in Inverloch with the dig that's run by Pat Vickers-Rich and Tom Rich at the Museum of Victoria.
Dinosaur Cove.
I went to Dinosaur Cove for a scouting trip once, but I spent a lot of time digging up fossils at Inverloch on the beach at Flat Rocks.
How exciting. And how did that take you to Oxford?
So I first came over to Oxford to do a postdoc after my PhD back in 2013, and I've stayed here ever since.
What's your research?
So I'm interested in using big databases of information about the fossil record to try and understand how modern biodiversity came to exist over deep time. So there's obviously a spectacular number of species alive today, but at some point in the very distant past, there were none. So I'm trying to understand how this diversity came to exist over deep time.
And how will those fossils illustrate it for you? Genetics I could understand, but there are no genes down there.
Yeah, so the fossil record is our only direct evidence for ancient patterns of biodiversity and how biodiversity varied across time and space. And so it has an awful lot to tell us about how biodiversity came to exist and also, therefore, the processes that give rise to biodiversity and regulate it over extended periods of time.
If you are looking at it from the sky, you might think that what nature might like to do is just consolidate, almost keeping the immigrants out, in other words. So you just build your stable population instead of having all that multiplication that produces uncertainty, perhaps.
That's definitely something that you can study in the fossil record. And there are some spectacular examples of these kind of natural immigration experiments. So the Great American Biotic Interchange, for example, which resulted in species from North and South America mixing together, that resulted in massive disruption to ecosystems.
So where are you looking and what are you finding so far?
My main work is essentially reassessing the kind of classical interpretation of the fossil record. So paleontologists have got an awful lot to offer in terms of understanding how biodiversity came to exist. But in the past, paleontologists have tended to focus on understanding diversity through time by essentially tallying up all of the species that are known for each interval of geological time. But some work that I've done has shown that you really can't take these global diversity curves at face value because the spatial extent of the fossil record, so how fossils are distributed across the Earth's surface, varies an awful lot through geological time. So, for example, on land, for tetrapods, terrestrial tetrapods like mammals and birds and reptiles and so on, the extent of the distribution of fossil localities across the Earth's surface essentially decays exponentially as you go further back in time. And this is because sediments that contain these fossils become progressively more buried and eroded and so lost to the fossil record. And so a kind of literal reading of this fossil record of tetrapods suggested to paleontologists that diversity had been increasing more or less exponentially to the present day. But I've shown that if you focus on really well-studied, well-understood regions of the globe and compare them across time and space in a more robust way, this exponential increase essentially disappears, and you have long periods of tens of millions of years of no change in diversity on average. But then you sometimes get major increases associated with profound ecological disruption. So, for example, after the end Cretaceous extinction that wiped out the dinosaurs, there was a very rapid rebound in diversity to maybe three or four times the previous level as mammals explosively radiated into the niches that were left vacant by dinosaurs.
Yeah, there was space. Now, I want to give you a thought experiment leading from what you've just said. If you listen to Mike Archer and a couple of others, they have worked with people who are examining the Earth from the sky, in other words, satellites. Because the idea is you can look at, say, Riversleigh, which is in northern Queensland. It's so rich in all those monsters that Archer and his team have been digging up for some years. And you can see signs of where the next digs should be. And you can do that to some extent with human remains as well, where people have been. And one of the problems is because you cannot recruit students to do paleontology or archaeology especially, because the archaeology is deemed to be a humanities course, it's twice as expensive to do, and so you're not getting the students. So Archer and people in archaeology are desperately looking for your successors, may I say, Dr. Close. How do you solve that problem?
I think it's about educating the students who are coming into the university system. If they're going into a geology degree, for instance, it's not just a kind of direct course to the mining industry, for instance. There's an awful lot of primary research that you can do in the field, and it also sets you up with all sorts of transferable skills that are useful for all sorts of different industries.
Do you think that is going to work, or has it not been said already? Because by the time you've actually trained your paleontologists and trained your archaeologists, it might be 5 or 10 years from now.
I don't think we're having this problem in the UK. I mean, it might be a bit of a different situation in Oxford, because we only take about 30 students each year. And so we might not be witnessing the scale of the problem you might see in Australia if you have much larger intakes of undergraduates. So we can be a lot more selective.
And you think perhaps there might be a few spare archaeologists and paleontologists coming from America, given the circumstances?
I think that's highly likely.
Finally, what next for you with your work?
So actually, the work that I'm planning over the next few years kind of touches on the work that Mike Archer is planning on doing. So I'm interested in understanding how the distribution of species across latitudes changed over deep time. So today, one of the most striking features of how species are distributed across Earth's surface is something that we call the latitudinal diversity gradient. So it's essentially describing how diversity declines from the equator to the poles. But at some points in the past, when Earth's climate was really hot, the fossil record appears to show that this kind of gradient of diversity didn't exist, perhaps because species couldn't survive at hot equatorial latitudes. But the trouble is that this pattern might be confounded with the way that fossils are sampled across the globe. So some of the recent work that I've done in marine animals over the last few hundred million years, for instance, shows that the peak of diversity across paleolatitudes essentially tracks Europe and North America from the southern hemisphere across the equator around the end Permian mass extinction and then into the northern hemisphere paleotemperate regions. And this seems highly unlikely. I think this is primarily a signal of bias. So the work that I'm going to do is to try and collect a lot more data about the kinds of potentially fossil-bearing deposits that are out there to see whether it might just be because we're missing some components of the fossil fauna from these low-latitude regions. And I think that there's potentially a role for this kind of satellite imagery in that.
And a role for the new students waiting by to follow you up.
Absolutely.
There I go, trying to recruit fossil hunters again. Well, we need them. Dr. Roger Close, paleontologist in Oxford.